What's up, guys? Doug Polk here, and welcome back to another episode of the Doug Polk Podcast. Today, we are joined by poker player turned crypto investor, Jordy Alexander, joins the podcast. Should be a great one. Plenty of stuff to talk about. Bitcoin stagflation, a little bit of NFT chatter, the Lux project. We'll talk a little bit about that. And of course, Ponzi's. What's the line on entering cryptocurrency Ponzi's? Plenty of great discussion to be had there. But before we jump into that, I want to let you guys know we've got an exciting series coming up on the podcast. Starting next week, I'm going to be joined by Mike Brady. Some of you guys might know him from Upswing Poker. And we're going to start a three-part series on who is the greatest poker player of all time. We're going to start with a large list of players, and you, the audience, is going to be able to vote. So stay tuned for that. Next Tuesday, we'll be back at 10 a.m. Pacific time. We'll figure it out eventually, and you guys are going to get a chance to listen to the arguments and vote, and we're going to try and get it down to just the best player in the world over 3 weeks' time. Should be a fun one, and I'm looking forward to seeing what Mike has to say. We'll present the case. You guys decide. Okay, with that out of the way, briefly, before we hop into the action today, I want to let you know that today's podcast is brought to you by CoinFlex. CoinFlex is a cryptocurrency derivatives exchange, and it is the home of crypto yield for people to both trade and earn crypto. The CoinFlex platform provides an array of products that serve investors and traders of all skill levels, from passive beginners to active experts. What I'm most excited about with our new partnership with CoinFlex is exploring the many opportunities that people can use to make money today. Just today, there was an opportunity where funding was negative on CoinFlex but positive on the other platforms. So you could short ETH somewhere else, long ETH on CoinFlex. Boom, you're profiting the funding. That's just one example of the many ways you can use CoinFlex to make money today. CoinFlex can help you make the most from crypto, allowing you an opportunity to take charge and chart your own course to your financial destiny. So what are you waiting for? Head on over and check out CoinFlex at www.coinflex.com. Legal disclaimer, none of the information contained here constitutes an offer to buy or sell any currency, product, or financial instrument, to make any investment, or to participate in any particular trading strategy. We now bring in today's guest, Jordy Alexander. Jordy, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Doug. Excited to be here.
Glad to have you. Actually, one more thing before we get into the topics today. I want to let the audience know we're going to start a new segment. And this is something I'm going to be doing moving forward. At the end of the segment, we're going to have a new segment called Have I Mentioned My Personal Life? And I'm going to be telling a story or two of things that have happened to me over the last week or so and just kind of chit-chat about life in general. I had a couple of different topics that I really wanted to get into. I got a funny story, and then, of course, I've had a recent battle with an Airbnb host. We'll talk about those at the end of the podcast. And, of course, if you have any personal stuff, you can throw it in there as well, Jordy.
I'll let you take the lead on that one, I think.
Perfect. Sounds great. Okay, so let's get down to business here, and let's kind of kick this off with this is going to be a very cryptocurrency-themed conversation today. Of course, we have a little intersection of poker and crypto here on the podcast. And today we're going to be a lot more over in the Bitcoin cryptocurrency sphere of things. I wanted to start off with sort of your macro views on where you sort of see the market today. What are some of the main themes that are important to be aware of as you're trying to make decisions in terms of what you're going to allocate towards? Maybe just some macro viewpoints on the cryptocurrency market today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the main headline is we've kind of entered a different cycle right now compared to this sort of 18-month period since the airdrop started happening from the U.S. government. Since the beginning of the year, we've seen a shift in the Fed, the rates. Obviously, equities are not anymore going to be in up-only mode. So that kind of filters through to crypto. It filters through to like any risk asset, and it just kind of changes the paradigm. So hopefully people have been aware that this has happened. You know, they can't just buy every dip and assume that, that's the easy money. Now I think like dips can keep going. And, the main thing is like speculative stuff that is what you would consider like a luxury good, like, you know, a meme coin or like a meme stock. It's going to have a much harder time now. So that's like the really big picture macro shift that we've seen. So what that means allocating is generally like you want to find things that are still having a lot of momentum. The momentum can still kind of pass through the headwinds that we're having on the rate side, on the tightening side. Even though like money is leaving the system, there is still a lot of like money around. And if you find like the right themes, that can work. So you know, some of the things from last year, like L1 rotation, obviously we had like, you know, Ethereum started, and then we just had like all the way, it was like first Solana, then like AVAX, like all these other L1s. And, you know, we've all gone to like Near and Harmony or some of like the latest ones. I think that thesis will probably continue. It'll be a little bit weaker than it was last year, which is automatic. But I think if there's something that is good tech, it'll get a chance to get funding, create an ecosystem. I think we're very much at this like smart contract stage where every like possible solution is getting its like moment to shine, like it's 5 minutes of fame. And the ones that survive in the end are going to be the ones that really manage to build like a very good ecosystem. So I think we're still in the exploratory phase, and I'm still sort of bullish on like some of the L ones.
Well, it's good to hear that the rotators of the world are going to continue to shine here, although maybe they won't be performing quite as well as we saw in 2021. Going back and just talking about up only mode for equities. And this is something that I've thought about a decent amount lately, where when we look back on sort of the Trump era of the US government, it was a very pro stock market, very let's make the stock market go up type of strategy. And I feel like, well, not I feel like, but rather a disproportionately large percentage of the tax that the US takes in has been coming from capital gains lately. I think year over year, it just gets higher and higher and higher in terms of the amount of money that's brought in via capital gains versus ordinary income. And so my question to you would be, isn't there going to be a bit of pressure here from on the US government side to continue these gains in the markets? Because if they don't, and they don't have these sort of up years, you might see a dramatic drawdown in the amount of income that is being generated for the government. And so do you think there's going to be a pressure from the Fed, from the US government, to continue this up-only mode for equities?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, actually. There's a huge pressure. We saw like a lot of the states that were supposed to go bankrupt, like California, they're like swimming in cash now because of exactly what you mentioned, like how much capital gains was realized from stock gains, especially like in that area with all, you know, the number of developers and other people who are working for Google and Apple and everything else, having to pay capital gains. So there is a huge pressure because it relieves a lot of the debt problems that both states and the federal government have. On the other hand, you know, the even bigger pressure right now is, you know, people who are very ordinary people going to shop for food or going to fill in their gas tank are having a lot of inflation. And even though we were told for like, you know, I would say like the word of the whole decade, I was thinking about this, like, it's very possible that at the end of the decade, the word transitory will be like the word of the decade, because we were kind of told that, you know, this inflation is going away, like it's just some supply things, it'll get resolved right away. And then the numbers just keep going from like 3 to 4, 5, 6, 7, 7.5 now. There's nothing transitory about this. The problem is, even things like energy costs keep rising because there hasn't been enough investment in oil. And even though like in the future, we want to get to like a green carbon-free state, in the meantime, we do need oil. And since there hasn't been enough investment, oil has gone up a lot, and that will just kind of keep an inflationary pressure. So even though the government does want to keep up only mode, I think right now their priority is pretty clear, is like they do first have to keep inflation under control. And I think there's going to constantly be this sort of like zigzagging back and forth. Like as soon as inflation comes back down, like a little bit, like to like 5% or 4%, they're going to get like so excited. Like, okay, like, we're done, guys. Like, let's go back to like, you know, pumping assets. And then it's just going to be like back and forth. So I think we're going to be in this like uneasy mode of like, you know, are they tightening? Are they kind of backing off? Are they blinking? Are they going to keep going? And I think at some point something will break, but they'll have a period where they'll just sort of bounce back and forth.
When you mentioned the inflation stance, it does actually, it is pretty funny. And there was this one meme that I loved where it's the meme where there's all the different brains, and there's the smaller brain, then there's the brighter brain, and then there's like the galaxy brain. And it's like, there isn't inflation. The inflation is small. The inflation is transitory. And then the galaxy brain was, the inflation is good.
It's right? Good.
It's good. It turns out it was good all along. I would drive it a little bit differently with why I think we're going to see some real pressure on politicians to change this year, because I agree with you. When most people are not worried about how much capital gains are being paid because they're broke, right? And so when you're trying to live your life and your income isn't increasing by very much, yet at the same time your cost of goods is increasing dramatically, you feel that pain. And the one thing that really holds politicians' feet to the fire is elections. When you have elections, all of a sudden people, you know what? I care a lot about cost of goods because I want to be here next year. So I think that the elections coming up this year probably are going to play a pretty reasonable sized role in Congress's care about the direction of inflation today.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a huge topic. I think like the Democrats are really feeling the pressure. Ultimately, they'll have to do something about it. But the thing with inflation is, you know, you can do everything, you know, use all the tools in the toolkit. It's going to take like 6 months to actually come down. It's not the kind of thing that you can just change overnight. It's not like you're going to go to like each store and just like force them to change the prices down. Like, it's going to take a while for these effects to filter through. So even if they start, you know, now, you know, even by November, it's not like things are going to be back to normal in terms of like steady prices.
These things definitely take time. It's not something easy to solve, like gun control. No, I'm just kidding about that one, obviously. All right, so going back, let's talk about Bitcoin specifically. There's been a good amount of conversation about Bitcoin's value and its role today. I feel like more than I've ever seen before, a lot of people that are extremely bullish on cryptocurrency sort of removing much allocation towards Bitcoin at all. But maybe they go into more of a, you know, 70, 80, 90% Ethereum mode or half Ethereum with a lot of Solana or Avalanche or these other L1s. I'm seeing more and more people kind of move away from just this pure Bitcoin allocation and get more involved in these other L1s that they find more interesting. Bitcoin being the dinosaur coin, as a lot of them would call it.
Boomer coin.
At the same time, though, we still see when larger institutions enter the cryptocurrency market, they mainly move towards Bitcoin. It's the safest. It's the store of value. It's been around the longest. And so it's kind of interesting when I see these conversations play out online, because for a lot of people, I'm surprised. They say, oh, they're not taking exposure to Bitcoin. But then I see a lot of people that they say, what? It should be your main hold. So kind of where are you at today in terms of what you think Bitcoin's future holds and sort of its relation to the rest of the cryptocurrency market?
Yeah, absolutely. I've thought about this quite a lot. You know, you have to take like human psychology into account. And we saw like last year where altcoins just did better than Bitcoin across the board. I mean, almost all of them really kind of outperformed. You can call them a high beta stock. And like, you know, Bitcoin was like a beta one and everything else was like a high beta. And that's true to an extent. But what you actually see is like there's a lot of greed going on when prices are going up and people want to capture as much of it as possible. And that's like human nature. It's like basic game theory. Like you'll do what's best for you individually. So, you know, that worked extremely well in an environment like last year where you have a lot of growth, you have a lot of like money printing and, you know, everything's going up. There's just like a lot of push. You want those like high beta things. You know, the thing with Bitcoin is there's this game that used to exist, like it was very popular 20 years ago called like good and evil or something. Like you're kind of like a god and you can decide, do you want to be a good god or a bad god? And I think actually like the effect of Bitcoin, the one that really kind of like pushes it to the next level, is not the good Bitcoin where like, oh, like, you know, we're all allocating like a little bit to Bitcoin and like, yeah, we're also like putting things in shitcoins and everything's going up and it's all good. I think the Bitcoin that is really going to like, you know, force the next like level of adoption is going to be the evil Bitcoin. And what I mean by that is it's very likely that this year we'll end up even more and more in a stagflation environment. So stagflation is a word that you're only starting to hear rumbles about, like stagflation. Like it's starting to like pop up in a few like news articles and a few Telegram chats. I think, you know, by mid-year and like towards the end of the year, it'll be like in every news article, they'll be talking about stagflation. So stagflation is basically going to be a state where the growth, like GDP, has like stagnated. Like we're not going to just keep having like 5-7% GDP. On the other hand, like inflation will really not go back to like, you know, sub 2%. Like it'll stay sort of elevated. So stagflation is really bad for stocks, especially growth stocks with high P ratios like tech stocks. It's an environment where like the FANG trade that has been like eating the world for the last 10 years will start to have some headwinds, like the Teslas of the world. Like everything will start compressing in like the price to earning ratio. So in that environment, you know, you're losing money in cash because of inflation. You're losing money like buying like tech stocks and like traditional investing. bonds are just going to be crap. Like, you know, bonds just keep going down because like rates are going up. So, you know, what you have is like traditional 60-40 portfolio, you know, boomer stuff, bond equities are going to get wrecked. A lot of cryptos are going to get wrecked because they are like more like speculative stocks in a way, like they are like high growth stocks, most of them. So ultimately, like you will see gold do pretty well. And we're already starting to see like gold now, like in this environment, even though like it's not supposed to be good for gold, it is starting to do well. And I think that Bitcoin will potentially like reach this new level where people, like you said, many of them are like underallocated to Bitcoin. They've been like kind of spreading into like other things. And it won't be like a nice, oh, like, hey, I'm over here, I'm Bitcoin, like come play with me. It'll be the sort of thing where like you're going to miss the train and like your spending power will go down unless you are in hard money. And Bitcoin will potentially kind of be this like, you know, dictator it's like you won't have a choice. Like, do you want to like have Bitcoin or like, you know, you're in trouble.
So basically what you're saying is for a long time with Bitcoin, it's been the carrot or the stick, and we've been dangling the carrot in front, which is come nibble on this delicious coin, but it's going to turn into the stick of anything else is going to do poorly. But Bitcoin is still a lot more speculative than these other assets. It's less lendy than gold. It's more speculative than total stock market ETFs. So is it really going to be a safe haven in these desperate times when that theory has been around for a long time with Bitcoin? But if we look at the price action of Bitcoin over the last several years, it tends to be levered stock market values. Obviously, there's exceptions. It depends if MicroStrategy is buying its next round of Bitcoin or not. But at the same time, we tend to see levered results in the Bitcoin price relative to the stock market. How can we be so safe saying or be so secure in thinking that, well, if shit really hits the fan, we enter a stage of stagflation? And by the way, that's a pretty cool take there. And if I see stagflation, I'm definitely going to think back to this podcast every time I see it. But if we see this happen in the stock market, how can we feel confident in Bitcoin's price holding when the reality is Bitcoin is a lot more speculative than these companies that at least are earning some revenue, even if their PE ratio is 100 or 200 or 500 or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I mean, we can't know for sure because it is the first time that we've had stagflation in 40 years. And obviously, Bitcoin did not exist in the 1970s. We had gold, and gold did incredibly well as people were like scrambling. So my main like Bitcoin thesis is like the real price of Bitcoin has like three elements, and you multiply like three elements and like you kind of get to like what's a fair price of Bitcoin. So one element is like the network effect of Bitcoin. So on that side, like I think it's just like pure game theory. We do see that like, you know, the first country, the first company, the first one to like adopt it will be able to buy it lower than the next one, who is going to always like buy it higher because the network effect of Bitcoin will like raise the price. So like as more and more countries like Brazil and like all these other kind of like Latin American countries get in, it's like a standard game theory thing where like, you know, whoever goes first, they're like incentivized because they can get in at a lower price. So, you know, companies like we saw KPMG, like they just like tweeted GM the other day and like announced like we are putting it on our books. Both companies and countries are sort of like in this incentivized world where they do want to like be first. So network effect is like one thing which kind of captures like the value of Bitcoin. The next thing is like, you know, dollar devalue, like what's the dollar index? So that's just like a very standard one. It's true for all assets. As long as you denominate in dollars, if the price of something goes up two times, that can just be purely because the dollar got devalued by two times. So that's just kind of like a standard thing. I think that drove things quite a lot last year. Like part of like the appreciation for like the last 18 months, I think, was from dollar devaluation. That's going to kind of stop now because they will have to like tighten things a little bit. But the third thing, which is kind of like what comes up in stagflation, is what is the demand for this product? Like, what is the demand for like having this good of Bitcoin as hard money? And I think like when things are good, like there is no demand for hard money. Like, why would anyone care about hard money when you can like 20x on like some shitcoin? And like, you know, no one's talking about stagflation. No one's talking about like trying to preserve your wealth. Everyone's talking about how like, you know, they just flipped like their house for like 3x. So, you know, the demand for hard money aspect, I think, is completely mispriced because we haven't needed hard money. And I think that's what's going to suddenly get like repriced in the market at some point. And
just to play devil's advocate. Yeah. Just to play devil's advocate on that for a moment. you say there's no demand for hard money and that people are more likely to buy into these speculative things, which, you know, certainly is true to some extent. At the same time, Bitcoin in the last 5 years has gone up 3 to 5x, depending on when you want to look at exact tops and whatnot, maybe even larger, of course, from its dip to its peak. So we say there's no demand for hard money, but then Bitcoin's price still did tremendous over that segment of time. And then that starts to beg the question, is it hard money if we're going to have those kinds of spikes during a time when people don't need hard money?
I mean, there was a good advertisement for Bitcoin. I think like Pomp was really the first one who really, you know, went on YouTube and just blazed it all over the place. Like, they're printing all this money. They are printing, you know, so much money. And like, this is like the solution to it. I think, you know, he did a good job. We got things to this 3 to 5x, like you said. But ultimately, like in the environment where they're just printing money and everything is good, you don't need hard money. Like, it's just true. Like, you can have any asset. You can have oil. You can have metals. You can have lumber. Like, you can have anything. Like, anything will go up. Like, you don't actually need hard money. You need hard money when, like, there's no growth. They can't, you know, keep printing, but there is inflation. And that's, like, really where the game changes.
Okay, that's fair. Other thing I wanted to mention here, you talk about the game theory aspect to Bitcoin of Bitcoin's price is only going to be 21. I'm paraphrasing your argument a little bit here. There's only going to be 21 million because of network effects. More and more people are going to enter into Bitcoin. The more countries that are going to get into Bitcoin, you're incentivized to be one of the first ones. You know, I think of El Salvador has been proudly buying up every Bitcoin that they can buy, right? So they're ahead of the curve. You know, you got to give credit where credit is due. But from a game theory perspective, that makes sense if a lot of these countries are going to get involved. But the argument might be on the other hand here. Okay, if I know that 50 countries are going to enter into Bitcoin in a big way, yeah, I want to be one of the first ones. But if I think that they're not, then I just enter in here and I'm the last one. And if you're the last one, that's kind of the other side of the game theory here, right? Let's just say that 100 countries are already heavily into Bitcoin. You don't want to be the 101st country if you feel like no one's coming in behind you. So couldn't there be an argument to be made that because after this many years, these larger countries haven't entered, that you might be on the back end of that instead of the front nine?
I think there is going to be like you said, the people who are late to the game, like Donald Trump, like he's made his money in traditional, real estate and whatever. And he's very anti-crypto because he doesn't have any and he just wants to preserve his wealth in like the traditional world. So there will be people who are late to the game that will be against it. I think on the game theory side, you know, we just saw something really interesting that happened globally, which is, some of the countries like Russia who seem to be against it, they just kind of realized like actually game theory wise, it is net positive for us that Bitcoin and crypto exists because we have miners. We can we have a lot of the Bitcoin in this country. So this is positive for us. And the most interesting thing I saw is actually like India similarly decided that because they have a very tech savvy population who is able to create startups in this space. And we've seen like how many crypto startups are incredibly like well founded by like starting teams from India. India has decided to like, they were about to ban it. And now they're actually like, you know, completely changing their tune on it. And what we've seen is Pakistan is now talking negative about crypto and they're saying like, you know, they want to ban it. And it kind of makes sense. Like if India is going to support it, then Pakistan's going to go against it. If, you know, once China banned it, then the US is more comfortable to like support it. So we will see like, not everyone's going to be on board and the people who are late to the party are not going to be like supporting it. That's true.
It is kind of like that. The moment that someone takes a stand and it's your friend, you feel like you need to stand with them. And if it's your enemy, you feel like you need to stand against them almost no matter what the thing is. There's a little bit of a difference with cryptocurrency because it is so broad. There's so many different kinds of currencies. And then even within the political spectrum, you look here in the US, you have people like Elizabeth Warren that are, you know, trying to prevent terrorists from having crypto because stable coins could, you know, something Al-Qaeda, something, or whatever the argument was. I remember watching that and it just seemed like a bunch of nonsense. But you still do have two sides here in the U.S. And it's been kind of interesting looking at a lot of the takes from politicians. I think, at least from what I've seen so far, I feel like, typically speaking, Republicans have been a lot more pro-cryptocurrency than the Democrats have.
With a lot
of the Democrats coming from the side of, you know, these are rich people that are trying to escape taxes or terrorists or this or... So I guess it'll be interesting to see kind of how that plays out locally.
I mean, you live in Texas right now, right? So like Texas is potentially like, you know, a huge crypto sort of center with all the mining now, and like a lot of the local politicians, like you said, like Ted Cruz and everybody else, they're starting to champion it.
It was a dark day when I saw Ted Cruz was coming in there and he's just being the guiding beacon of light, and he's saying to the Senate, you know, guys, maybe we shouldn't regulate something. We have no clue what it is. Five of us in this room understand what Bitcoin even is. Maybe we should make a bunch of laws. And I'm thinking, holy shit. I agree with Ted Cruz on this one. Ted Cruz is my guy on this subject.
It's painful. I'm with you on that one. I never thought this, you know, I would be in this spot. But it's exactly right. And I've heard, you know, theories about, you know, Texas could, as this evolves, could end up being like a very strong political force for Bitcoin, because it will be like so good for the state if it does well.
Texas is very pro-business, obviously. Everyone's known that for forever. And so with a lot of the cryptocurrency stuff, it was like, this is an opportunity for Texas to establish more business. Riot, they purchased a place called Whitstone. It's like a cryptocurrency mining facility. I went out there for their investor day. And my buddy Jason Les, he's the CEO, went around the place with him and all the other investors. And man, it's some serious Bitcoin mining going on out there. The number of miners and they're just building these massive units of these huge buildings, miners all the way through them. You can go inside like a house of mining machines, and it sounds like swarms of bees everywhere. It's incredible the size of everything. It's nuts what's going on. But there's a lot of different mining operations happening more and more in Texas, people moving to Texas. Definitely Texas, certainly a central hub for a lot of cryptocurrency stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, like the left is gonna like have certain elements of it that are against crypto, and I think there, you know, obviously a lot of people who do own the most crypto are on the left, because it is a Silicon Valley kind of heavy space, and everybody in Silicon Valley is generally like left leaning. So I don't think that it'll be purely for Republicans. Like people like SBF, obviously, like they donate huge to like the Biden side. And I think, you know, we could eventually have a lot of both sides of the aisle kind of candidates supporting it.
Yeah, I do think that the biggest component of this is just, I don't really think it's a left versus right issue. I just think it's a who's paying me now issue. And yeah. I think that the sides that are donating the most, certain politicians are probably going to be the most heard. And, you know, probably safe to say Senator Karen doesn't have a lot of cryptocurrency people in her corner. Slinging the writing the checks, so I'm sure it's more of just a virtue of the way the political system works in America, and people basically supporting the people that support them, you know, which is exactly how our founding fathers intended for the system to work. But regardless, I do think that we'll see a fairly neutral stance on at some point. I do think this is going to become a big enough issue with enough market cap where there's going to have to kind of be sides that are drawn a little bit. And I'm kind of interested to see how this goes, because what's happened with almost every other issue is that it turns into an issue where large portions of the country on each side, one of the parties just ends up kind of putting into their platform, we're pro this or against this, and the other side takes the other side. It'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out over our lifetimes. I wonder if in 20 years from now, we look back and think, wow, I can't believe Democrats used to be anti-Bitcoin, or I can't believe Republicans used to be pro-Bitcoin or whatever. I feel like at some point there's going to be a policy more party-wide. We're getting kind of into a territory. I didn't know if you want to take this conversation, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like there's much more uncertainty than just like what are the parties going to do with crypto. I think just the political uncertainty with like the potential return of Trump and what that's going to do to the country. And I've heard some very, very smart people that I'm sure talk to me a lot lately about like states seceding. Like they think, you know, in certain situations, the Republic could be under threat in terms of like some states just deciding like, you know, they don't want to be a part of it. And it's something that would sound crazy like 20 years ago, but you know, the uncertainty I think is much wider than just on the crypto side politically in the US.
I think that's also a function of how good things have been for so long. When there's no imminent threat to your well-being, it's easy to say, let's just split up and do our own thing. But then when it turns into, oh man, China is going to overtake all of us, all of a sudden you don't want to be your own country. You kind of want to be part of a big block that's a very strong block. So that's a little bit of a function of how good things have been for some time. There are definitely states that don't make any sense. Like California should really be multiple states. It's the biggest state in terms of population, in terms of GDP. It's just by far the largest state. So, and then if you look at geographically, the inland areas versus the coastal cities, the north versus the south, the agricultural centers versus the Silicon Valley versus the Los Angeles versus the Orange County versus the deserts in the southeast. It's just chock full of different areas, both geographically and financially and every other way you want to look at it. So you can make a great argument that state should be somewhere between 2 and 7 states instead of just the one giant state that it is today. But in terms of like a full on secession, I don't know if I could see that. I mean, it's not.
I'm not sure either. Like I don't see it easily either. I'm just starting to note a lot of really kind of clued in people starting to just look into this quite a bit. Texas is definitely one of the other states that's mentioned very often.
Well, Texas already views itself as sort of its own country, so that works out for everyone. It's you're in Texas down here. You're not in America. Depending on who you ask, I guess. There is definitely a sentiment. I heard a player at my table at the lodge the other day, a great poker room you guys should come check out. But at my table the other day, someone said, you know, California really, really fucked things up with just the way that they managed the state. And I know it's a little Texas-y to kind of agree with that sentiment, but I do kind of agree with that sentiment overall. California, and the player said this, he said that California was the best state. They had the best state, and kind of where things are at today, where it's like, let's try and solve the problems by upping taxes again. There's always some new rate tax. Guys, at some point, it's not about the fact that you're not taxing people enough. It's about mismanaging the state. There are some other aspects at play. Like, for example, one kind of interesting thing about California is when you look at the forest fires, we're really off in the weeds here, but I want to share this. So when you look at the forest fires in California, it's been a big issue over the last 10 years, 15 years. And there has been a historic drought, which is the main cause here, right? There's increasing temperatures, historic drought. But at the same time, I think something like 50-ish%, maybe even a slight majority of all of the land in California is owned by the federal government. It's an astonishingly massive amount of the land. And when you look at where the forest fires happen, it tends to happen on land that is owned at the federal level. And so people blame California for mismanaging their forests. Well, a lot of it is actually the federal government should be managing those forests better. That's not an argument that I hear talked about basically at all. And I'm not trying to absolve California of, you know, its problems within the state, but a surprising amount of the fires actually do come from a lot of these federal lands, and they need to be doing more controlled burns. But
yeah,
bottom line in California, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived in California and I left, like the fires are just one thing, you know, the crime is like the biggest thing for me. Like I got my car broken into like 5 times over a year. And like once it was like twice in a row where like they already like smashed one window. I didn't even have the chance to fix it. They could have just gone in through like the broken window.
Oh, but that's
so they smashed the other side. So, like,
at that point, I think you're a target, man. You're like, oh, you couldn't just go in through the already broken window. You had to break yourself a new one. Oh my god.
Anyway, that was part of my experience there. But yeah, let's dive into you had such a nice picture kind of preparing people for one of the main topics we want to talk about. And I have gone back to I'm a big fan of like the work you did like a few years ago, even with like BitConnect, Ty Lopez. Oh man.
Classics.
You know, like the classic stuff. I mean, I went back, I was looking at some of that stuff again today. I mean, first of all, there's not many people who are able to like generate a ton of views and like a lot of like fun, like content and interest for something that is like against a scam or a Ponzi. Because, you know, if somebody promises you a lot of money and just says like, oh, buy this thing, like you're going to make $1 million. You just like follow my lead. That gets like views right away. Cause everyone is just like, you know, full of hopium and wants to buy in. If you're the guy saying like, okay, actually you're not going to make money. You're not going to be rich. Like this stuff doesn't work. Like you shouldn't do it. That doesn't like have the viral sense in itself. Like you have to kind of like wrap it into something and like, cause people don't want to hear like, you're not going to be rich. So,
Well, there's a balancing act there. it's kind of people that aren't a part of it do want to hear that video because they want to hear why they were right to not try and be rich. And then also people just love dunking on idiots, dunking on scammers. That as a content type is just the most popular content type because it's funny. It's funny to see someone that's trying to scam people or trying to mislead people or trying to take advantage of people just get wrecked looking like an idiot. That's like its own genre of just some of the most popular content online. So I wouldn't say that it's too hard. The difficult part is trying to make something that can oftentimes be very informational, trying to make it funny and interesting. And one of the reasons why it's more difficult today than it was, let's say, 4 years ago, is back in the day, man, the scams were just obvious. Like BitConnect was just, I remember looking at BitConnect and it's like, oh, our trading algorithm bot is just going to give you 1% a day or whatever. And I'm just like, that's a scam.
That's so classic.
That's a
so
scam.
Classic. Yeah. You know? I mean, that's like a classic. Very classic
but,
one.
But today it's like, okay, we have fractional reserve banking and it's going to represent shares in this thing. And then we have this aspect of it and this aspect of it. And you're sitting there. And I guess like the first one I think of is Ohm. I'm not super familiar with Ohm. Yeah. I've probably spent about 30 to 60 minutes of my life really trying to understand it. Obviously, I've heard all the chatter about Ohm and then the Ohm forks like time and all the Ohm stuff. But I looked at it and I was like, this seems sketchy, but there are just so many things going on now that am I really going to dedicate an extra 3 hours towards learning about this thing that I'm not going to enter because it's pretty sketchy? And the answer is no, there's just too much stuff happening. But maybe we start with there. Do you have a take on the Ohm? Maybe you can break down what Ohm is for some of our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. So like, you know, I was in a very similar position to you. I kind of spent 30 minutes looking at this thing. People were talking about it. Like you see this like 3-3 thing on like a bunch of Twitter profiles, like it's all over the place. I just ignore it. And then something like, hey, what is this thing? So I spent like 30 minutes at it. That's it. Just quickly looking through an exact same like feeling you got. And I think the reason we got that feeling is because when you see these types of things, but you don't find like somebody who's going to support this ecosystem, like who is putting money in? Who doesn't want to like just like make a quick buck? Like everyone who's getting in is just trying to like make a return. So whenever we see that, like I think as poker players, we're like, you know, if there's no sucker at the table, like, you know, what's going on? Like people are just sort of like trying to like win up each other. It's like a zero sum game. Like that's kind of like very natural to us. So, you know, what happened is like I went on Up Only and I briefly mentioned like in passing that like, yeah, like this Ohm thing looks like a Ponzi and Hex looks like a Ponzi. I mentioned like a few of them. There was like a list of them. And like, as soon as the thing aired, like this mob on like, you know, these guys are like so passionate that there's like thousands of them. They just start like this guy and Up Only, he said it's a scam. And they just like, start like, you know, who is this idiot? And you know, they just like start, and I'm like, okay, maybe there's something to look into here. Like this looks kind of like worth looking into if like it's getting such a reaction. Cause if it's not a scam, like, you know, they'll just ignore you. Like, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, we know what the reality is. This guy's just uneducated. So I did go down the rabbit hole and I would say like, I spent maybe like over Christmas, like vacation and like all this period. I don't want to say hundreds, but like maybe hundreds of hours, like really kind of digging in and like, you know, seeing and reading every single like thing about it. And I was not happy with what I found. So basically just to give like a quick kind of overview what this is, you know, Olympus DAO, they're a DAO, you know, which, like you said, is very different from a lot of the things we had in 2017, where a lot of the Ponzi's and stuff were just like some single guy or like, you know, some group like running it. When you have a DAO, like you've immediately kind of managed to create like a community with that's sort of like economically aligned. But anyway, like this DAO has a coin called Ohm, and the coin is supposed to become like the new reserve currency of the world. So that's kind of like another classic one. Like, you know, a lot of people have tried to become that. Everything from like, you know, Bitcoin Cash to like, there's just like so many examples. But, you know, this is like the goal is to become, you know, you read through the docs and it doesn't really make sense. Like, it's like, okay, it's not the dollar. It's not a stable coin, but it's not like Bitcoin, Ethereum. It's like sort of in the middle and, you know, we're going to be stable. But we're not going to be speculative. It's like, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. The thing that made it very popular is like the Ponzi-nomics around it, where, you're getting this like really high like return of tokens. They just keep printing more tokens and they keep giving you tokens. And if no one's selling, it's in a way like we've like everyone's like making money on paper, because you know, if this thing is worth like a dollar and no one's selling and we just give each other like 100 more of them, now we have $100. And if we give each other 1,000, but then as soon as somebody tries to sell like a little bit, like the price just goes away. So they did some really smart memes around like they're owning their own liquidity, which like is like another bullshit meme. And you know, bonding, you can do, they just try to make it so complex. And at some point, like I understood all of it. I really got into the weeds really deep, and I wrote a few articles about it. And you know, the community, as expected, as you would expect, like, I don't know, like what kind of, you know, when you've been doing videos against BitBoy and like all these kind of types, I don't know if you get like much pushback, but like, man, the omis, they come at you like every day. I'm like living rent free in their brain. It's just like constant, like flow every single day. How about you?
Oh, I've got plenty of communities that hate me. I don't even really know where I would start. The Bitcoin Cash community has not been a fan of me, although now I'm partnered with CoinFlex, and CoinFlex has a lot of Bitcoin Cash guys. So I think I'm a little more in the okay book. We've kind of settled it. And actually, this goes in sort of something in the last year or so. I've really managed to squash a good number of my beefs, and the Bitcoin Cash community and I, we get along pretty good now. But in terms
How about
of what people
Bitboy
are
the community,
the Bitboy community. But the thing is, like, I make fun of Bitcoin, BitBoy. It's like mainly people that are like, yeah, I don't even see the people defending him. I don't know. Maybe they don't even know who I am. Probably don't. The Hex guys seem pretty fanatic. That one is strong. But I wanted to push back a little bit on the when people are attacking you, you know that you hit a nerve, because one of the most rabid group of people, if you say something bad about it, are the Bitcoin maxis. They can be ferocious on Twitter. So I don't know if it's as much based around if something is a scam or not per se. That could play a role. I think it's about how religious it becomes to be a supporter of that community. And some communities, you know what it's kind of like a little bit? It's kind of like with Trump, how Trump did all of these things. And so you had so many times you could have gotten knocked off the fence either for Trump or against Trump. And there were plenty of people that ended up in both categories. But by the end, there was almost no one in the middle. Why? Because you had to decide 100 different times. It wasn't like you got to go, oh, I haven't heard about Trump in 2 years. You heard about Trump every single day. I was on Twitter. You see his tweet every single day. At some point, you kind of had to make a decision. What do I think about this guy? And yeah, there will always be some moderates. But most people were either like, I can't stand this guy, or I love what this guy's all about. And that's really kind of what happened. With Bitcoin maximalists, sort of the same thing. What are you going to tell a Bitcoin maximalist that they haven't heard already that's going to make them go, you know what, this is the wrong decision? It's the same kind of thing, I think.
There is some of that. I think like some of the like passion that, you know, you see in these communities, because they need the network effect. Like when we talked about like the Bitcoin, like the three pieces of like Bitcoin, like the network effect being one, like a lot of these projects, like they need that. Like something else, which is like pure tech. Like, you know, do you just like believe in like, you know, cross-chain lending and borrowing? Like, you, like as long as it works, like the tech is going to speak for itself. But like some of these things, it becomes around like how many brains can you like brainwash to like believe this thing? And, you know, Bitcoin has done a good job. It's brainwashed a lot of brains, and like I don't think it's the reserve currency of the world. Like I don't think it's anywhere close. Like maybe it'll become that like in you know the next 20 plus years. But like I know for sure that like some like new random small coin with like a community of like, you know, 100,000 people is not gonna like easily, it's just so many levels away from like being like a reserve currency. But in any case, like the main thing with like creating content for this type of thing now is like, it is like you said, like much more complicated now. Like the academic aspect of like needing to explain what is protocol owned liquidity, like what is like bonding, well, how does this actually work? It gets like, it's kind of like heavy. It can be math heavy. Like, you know, there's a lot of like math that gets into this stuff where like they just present like some math picture and you have to get to another PAX picture. If you're like trying to like be on the good side of things and like, you know, point out that things are not as presented, either you go like you write like an academic article, but then like who the hell like reads that? Like,
to continue on that point for a moment, with creating a lot of content about it, it's pretty difficult because when someone is looking at your content and they're looking for a reason to discredit you versus believe in you, people have a different set of beliefs or set of what they're looking for. And so let's say I make a video, and let's say I make a 15-minute well thought out video where I break something down and I fuck something up, because that happens. You're a human yes, being. You're making a video. Exactly. You fuck something up.
Exactly.
Lord knows I fucked stuff up in a video. People will point at it and they'll post and say, Doug is fucking wrong. He's an idiot. Look at this. And then they'll post something.
Because it's one thing, right?
And by the way, they'll be right. Well, hopefully not about the whole thing, but they'll be right about the post, right? Where I did make an error. And so what, does the whole video get discredited now? Well, at some point it gets extremely complicated. And a lot of what these sort of Ponzi-esque things do today is they add all these layers to it. And then if someone tries to break it down and they get something wrong, the community can say, look, that guy's an idiot. He got this one thing wrong. Can't believe him. And use that sort of as a shield. Yeah. And that makes it a lot tougher to make content and to be able to and to be able to, you know, accurately put information out there in a way that that community itself doesn't feel like they were wronged in some fashion. And then yeah. I also want to talk, just want to say briefly about the whole reserve currency thing. When I hear reserve currency, I'm putting it up there in the tier of super cycle and what's the new, when there's a whole new dimension or something, what's it called? New paradigm.
Paradigm shift.
Yeah. Those are all going in the top category of most memerific terms that people use to describe things. Ohm is not going to become the world's reserve currency. Bitcoin is probably not going to become the world's currency, but you know, maybe you want to debate that, and it depends on how you want to look at what a currency is, but it probably won't become that. So that's just simply not realistic and is a meme in its own right.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, the thing you touched on is so true. Like, you can't make like a single inch wrong, because, you know, it's a very asymmetric game. Like on like their side, you know, just full of like, you know, it's like Trump, like, you know, he'll just like, just say whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, no one's fact checking, just like, and then if you do like one tiny thing, you know, you're like immediately attacked. And, you know, in my case, I did think so carefully, like, I didn't actually get anything wrong. Like, nobody was able to disprove or question a single thing I said. So instead, what they do is like, did you talk about something else and say that something else was like good or bad? And then that, like, you know, like for me, like, it's been like, oh, you said time, you were supporting time. I never supported time. I said like, it's good that they're stopping using like, you know, the mechanics that Ohm is using. It's good that they're stopping that. And they're like, oh, well, time, you know, is a scam and you supported time. Therefore, everything you said about like our thing is not true. Like, it, like the level of like having to reach is crazy. But the thing that personally bothers me, and I think like should be addressed, is when someone like goes against the mob now and goes against like one of these like DAOs or like communities, it's such a like a defensive position to be in, not just because like you're getting attacked, but you know, it's like a standard thing when you're writing an article to give, you know, whoever like looks over it and checks your math and like, you know, you kind of give them some acknowledgement at the end. Man, I was not able to like put any fucking acknowledgement. Sorry. I could not put any acknowledgements.
You can say fuck on the podcast.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. All good.
I could not put any fucking acknowledgements on these pieces, even though like, you know, a lot of people did a lot of work. Like I said, like this is like heavily researched. As soon as you put anything like, you know, like 2 seconds later, like on Twitter, they're just like, oh, this guy's like also supporting, like they get attacked. And like, you know, my friends or contacts that like did anything to like help research this thing, they were sweating like that. I did not, they were just like scrolling down. They were like, I hope you didn't put me under acknowledgements. Like, I don't want to deal with this mob. Like, nobody wants to deal with this shit. Like, nobody does.
Absolutely true. And I actually have a question for you, Jordy. Do you think that it's okay to sometimes invest in these Ponzi schemes if you think you can do so profitably? And I'm going to hold your answer. I'm going to have that for you guys after the break, because I want to let you guys know that today's podcast is brought to you by CoinFlex. CoinFlex is a crypto's future exchange, which sees over $2 billion in daily trading volume. What the team has built on top of this powerful futures trading engine is a suite of innovative crypto yield products. CoinFlex is committed to making crypto yield accessible to everyone, and a cornerstone of that strategy is FlexUSD. FlexUSD is the world's first interest-earning stablecoin. What's that mean, guys? It means for every $1 in the stablecoin that you have in your wallet, you'll be sent money made by the repo market at CoinFlex every 8 hours on the 8 hours ends up being about 10 to 12%, 15%, depending on the rates, directly to your wallet. FlexUSD recently surpassed $360 million in market cap. I probably got to update that probably a little bit more by now, and has paid over $10 million in interest to holders in the last year alone. Creating FlexUSD is super simple and currently pays roughly about 12% annually. I was looking at some of the numbers earlier today. It does dip under 10 sometimes, so we'll see what the longer term rate looks like. But we'll say it's in that 10, 12, 15% range annually. I know this community can have mixed thoughts on cryptocurrency, but what we're talking about here is 10 to 15% return annually on US dollars. No exposure to those nasty financial downturns in Bitcoin and Ethereum price. Just interest in a USD stablecoin automatically sent to your wallet 3 times a day. To learn more about FlexUSD, head on over now to www.flexusd.com. Legal disclaimer, none of the information contained here constitutes an offer to buy or sell any currency, product, or financial instrument, to make any investment, or to participate in any particular trading strategy. Okay, Jordy, you had some time to mull over your answer here. Is it okay to suck on the teat of a likely Ponzi scheme?
That's a good question. I think about it a lot. By the way, you know, I'm having this like nostalgia now. You know, on your like CoinFlex thing, it just said, you know, Bitcoin 62.8. I wish we were back at 62.8. But just to get to your question, I think it's a little bit like poker. Like, you know, the pure like ethical, like where it's like completely clean is the sports side. You know, everyone is like world-class player. We're all putting our money. We just want to see who's going to do better and like try to like, you know, level each other. So if it's like a scheme where we all know we're playing like a pump and dump or some kind of game, and it's like, who's going to get out first and who's going to like time it right, and everybody knows what's going on, I think obviously that's fine. Like that's completely okay. If there's like kind of people who are not understanding the game, it gets a little bit murky, but I think it's still okay. Like, what do you think? I mean, in a way, like you can just simplify and say like, yeah, I'm going to like get into this Ponzi. Like I know how it's going to be played. I will like make a bunch of money that if I don't make, somebody else is going to make it, because it is zero sum, and like, you know, other people will make it, and you know, I'll donate like half of it to charity, and that's better what they would do. That's a good impact on the world. So like, I don't think it's necessarily bad to play the Ponzi games. Like, I don't know. How do you see it?
So I'm going to be very honest here. I like to be honest here on the podcast. And my main reason that I haven't entered into any of the Ponzi shit that's been going on is that I just don't think I'm talented enough to end up on the right side of it. And so I just can't live in a world where I enter a Ponzi and I'm the guy that gets scammed. I'm not willing to. So it looks Ponzi-ish. I'm out. And if I miss out on the 10x gains that my bros are getting, and I'm seeing memes all over my group chats, I'm okay living in that world as just a poor, not going to make it pleb who's investing in shit coins like Bitcoin and Ethereum or whatever else. I just don't feel like I have my finger on the Ponzi pulse enough to get in there. I also kind of don't want to support that stuff. I feel like whenever, so if I end up investing in something, it's usually because I believe in it in to some extent. Maybe it's only a short-term price window, or I think that the price is undervalued or whatever it is, but I tend to not buy things that I think are essentially scams. It's probably a good way of looking at investing for most people, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you'd be surprised, like just having a poker background, a lot of these things, if you do spend a little bit of time on them, you are definitely talented enough to figure out like, hey, like they're just printing tokens. You know, I just need to like stake it for this period of time and then get out, and like I've made some return. It's not like that difficult, because, you know, the type of people who like enter these things are quite unsophisticated. And as long as you understand the game, you're already able to like win.
Doesn't that kind of go against your earlier point, though, where you're saying once you have these people involved, it gets sketchy? And the reality is, I think when you're connected well in cryptocurrency, you kind of take for granted through the level of conversation you get to be a part of every day and hear about. I'm by no means a super knowledgeable guy about cryptocurrency when you compare it to the top of the top people. But when you're in these chats and you see some of the takes some of the guys have, and you think, oh, that's a cool point, that's a cool point, and you're getting to listen and absorb that information, you're already in the top whatever percent of people that are in terms of just the knowledge that's available to you. And then most people, they don't get to have that luxury. They just get to have, oh, there's this new thing called Ohm. they don't really understand the difference between Ohm and Bitcoin or whatever else. Should I buy some? Oh, it could go up a lot. Maybe I'll take a chance. Like, that's the way that people are looking at it.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, there's also a lot of inside information in general. Like, a lot of insiders just know when the announcement's going to come. When are they about to, like, release the next, like, you know, upgrade to their system? When are they about to, like, really, like, announce, like, that there's been a funding round? And like you said, most people are just sort of like reacting to the news and just kind of clicking away. And if you're in the loop, you know, that's maybe like one of the like unfortunate things that that there is like an information gap that is like huge. But, you know, we've had that in poker as well. Like, you know, a lot of people are just showing up at the table and they don't, you know, they've never read a book and they've never like, they don't know what a solver is. And then you have people who have just been like, you know, doing simulations every day for like the last 2 years. And then, you know, the line of sketchiness just goes like, you know, what's ethical, what's not. Like if you're playing under like a screen name that is not associated with you and people don't know it's you, is that bad? Like, are you not allowed your privacy? Like, I don't know, maybe that's okay. If you're like, you know, using multiple accounts to like re-enter a tournament, like, is that okay? Like, obviously, like, we went through this period in the poker world where we were kind of like figuring out like, oh, you shouldn't like use somebody else's account, but you can do this and this is bad. And it's like a lot of things, like, I don't think we're that bad. Like, I don't know what your take is, but like, for me, like, if you were just playing by yourself on like a different account, like, I don't know that was like necessarily a bad thing.
Well, it really depends here on the stakes that we're talking about. So in general, when you play on a site and you agree to the terms of service, you should abide by those things. So if the site says, hey, you're not allowed to have multiple accounts, that's the rules that we have here, then yeah, it's a bad thing to have another account. How bad it is matters a lot. If you're playing $1 tournaments on some large site and there are thousands and thousands of people, is it bad? You shouldn't do it, but is it that bad? No. What is that? A 2? Is anyone even really being affected? Doesn't mean you should do it, by the way. I'm not arguing that you can multi-account if it's small stakes. But then let's compare that to a drastic case. Let's say that you're playing high stakes for somebody and then they give their account to someone else, like I feel like Luke Schwartz did to me back in the day. And that's why he accuses me every time that I multi-accounted. It's the classic, you cheat on your partner and you blame them. Luke Schwartz, I'm on to you, regardless. Let's just say you're playing high stakes poker versus someone and they have someone else playing the account and now you have all these reads and all the stuff about them that you think that they play like. Well, then that's really bad because you're basically using someone else's alias to trick someone into losing money to you. So, I mean, it's all bad, but the scale can be anywhere from like a 2 to a 7 or an 8.
I mean, I totally agree. And some of these things, you know, are subjective. Like the thing you described, like the poker community did like kind of go hard at a lot of these things. They're saying like, well, you should just play under your own screen name. Even if you're not getting action and like no one's sitting you, like you should just still do that. And if somebody like tries to get action by playing a different screen name or like a new screen name, you know, they just make a new one. It was considered to be like a very big faux pas. I think it's a little bit misplaced. Like the other stuff is like so much worse. Like, if you think about it from like a game theory aspect, this like whole having pieces of other people and like how often and like these like high rollers and everybody else, that changes things like so dramatically. Like if you're playing like at a four-handed table and like two people like have pieces of each other, you know, it just, you know, it changes the game completely. And if it's just like you're playing under a different alias, at the end of the day, like, you know, if you're playing high stakes, you should be the best in the world or like close to it. And if some unknown account starts beating you, you know, like just get better or like, you know, just, you know, that's kind of part of the game. I don't know. Like it doesn't change the game theory.
I would maybe argue this the other way, which is, and I'm not trying to say either that no one's trying to say cheating or doing things to hurt other players is good. So just want to get that out of the way. But at least with the pieces thing, you haven't agreed to something as a player pool, right? When I enter the tournament, there's no note. You cannot have pieces of other people. And I say, yes, and then do it. Whereas with multi-accounting, that is what you're doing. You're entering a site, you're agreeing to terms that everyone agrees to, and then you're going against them. So I think there reaches a percentage of someone in a tournament where it certainly gets into unethical territory. What that line is, can be gray. And sometimes, let's say that you have only a few swaps or you're in a huge field and then you end up deep in a field with someone that you had one of your only swaps with, the stakes that you have swapped with that player can be huge. I don't exactly know what the solution to this problem is, though. Should you have to sign something that you can't swap with other players? Maybe at least then it's something, but don't you have that right as your tournament action? I mean, this is one of the issues. There's a lot of problems in poker, but this is one of the ones that I really don't know what the answer is, because let's be honest, we all know this. Everyone knows this. Yeah. In the high roller scene, the regs are all swapping.
Yeah.
The tier 1A regs swap with tier 1A regs. And then tier 1B, sometimes with tier 1A, if like it makes sense for the tier 1A guy to spread out his equity, and then the other tier 1B, and then the tier 2 regs, now they swap some, but like less because they might have opinions about each other. And then they always try and swap with the tier 1 guys. Maybe they get showered, maybe they don't. So that ecosystem
goes on. But it
happens
in cash games too. Like, it's not even just tournaments. And it, the impact in cash games is huge as well. Like, and you talk about like the private games sometimes, how like hard it is to get into these games and stuff. A lot of the ways people get into these games is by like promising some of their action to one of the other players who's kind of hosting or whatever. In a way, like, you start soft playing people, and it just changes the math of the game. Like, that's kind of like fundamentally why I have a bigger problem with, it's not even poker anymore. Like, the actual like ICMs and the game theories, everything kind of like shift when you're trying to optimize for like somebody else's utility, right?
Sorry, go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, I'm just saying, like, for me, like, at least that's different than just, not knowing who you're playing online. Like, when you're playing online, I think we all kind of like assume that, like, you could be playing against the bot, you could be playing against anybody behind a screen name. But when you're playing like in a tournament or like any like cash game, you kind of don't want to get ganged up on it. It just like completely changes the math.
So let's say you're in Vegas. You're in a lucky situation, okay? You get the invite to the JRB game. It's a good day to be alive. You get there, you sit down, JRB's in the game, and then there's Robo on the other end of the table, okay?
These are just made-up names and made-up examples, right?
It's not like hypothetically, okay. The JRB game, hypothetically, Andrew Robo. And everyone knows that JRB's in there and Robo are in there because they're both in there. Are we upset at the situation, or because it's public, it's not? Or like, is there an amount of equity that's okay? Or like, let's say that you're in a cash game and you're super high stakes, and then you had a 5% swap with somebody. Is that okay? If it's enough, is there a point where like the amount of equity doesn't matter? Right. Cause like, let's say you have a 5% swap with someone.
Yeah.
Then
I think like if it's public, like, I think it's definitely a lot better. Like, if everybody is okay with it, that's okay. Like, if for some reason, either they're just like very recreational and they're like, yeah, sure, like, I don't care, like, you guys do whatever you want, I think it's fine. If it's not public, which usually it isn't, people are not really like going out and just like showing their swap sheet to everybody, then they don't know what they're getting into. It's not as bad as like sharing cards, like, which, if you're playing Omaha Online, you have like 4 cards to share. It's not like quite that bad, but it's not that much better.
Well, what about this? What if you have a swap with someone, but you play identical? So the way that I always operated is, if I had a swap with people, and that happened a bunch in my career, I'm not like going to pretend it didn't, in tournaments or in cash games or whatever, if I had a swap with someone, I would play exactly the same. So I would not enter into my logic the fact that I even have a piece. So if I should run them over, I ran them over. If I thought I should squeeze, I should squeeze. If I thought I should fold, I would fold. Does it have, if it doesn't have a bearing on the way that you're actually acting, is it still bad?
No, it's not bad. But you might think it doesn't affect you. Like, it's hard to know, like, subconsciously. The mind changes a lot. Like, the brain is just like, I saw this, like, in crypto a lot. Like, when people own something, like Ohm, or like even going back, like Dogecoin, as long as you're like, you own a coin, you just look at it completely differently than the rest of the world. Like, for you, all the information, you're all seeing the same information, but you just process it like completely differently. And if you're like in that spot where you're talking about, where like you do have, let's say, like, maybe for you it's easy because like, you're kind of always in a good financial spot. you know, yeah, you're late in this tournament, and maybe like, you know, if you did change your play, like it would give you like another 100K of EV, but you know, you don't need it and you're okay. But if you were kind of like more desperate, even if you're trying to be ethical, are you really like being objective? Can you really like, you know, you have that ace nine suited. What was that? There was like some tournament recently where like somebody like was four-handed, raised ace nine and got like re-raised by ace jack and then like folded for like a few big blinds, like a shove. Like, I don't know. Maybe he was thinking that even though he has a piece of the other guy, like maybe he was thinking he's just acting normally and then like folding ace jack to like, you know, 60% more chips is the right decision. It's hard to know like what was going on in his brain. Like maybe he actually thought it was okay.
I don't know the hand exactly that you're referencing, but what I would actually put these into slightly different segments. I think cash games and tournaments are just overwhelmingly different. And so like with cash games, at least when I was more sharp than I am today, when the action would get to me, I would have a visualization in my head of what my range should look like. And so I would know, like, regardless of who opened or who, what, I would be like, okay, I'm going to be reasoning about this range. So I think I could more or less operate entirely independently of I have a piece of X person in anything because I know or knew what my range should look like, and I can be unbiased about that. Tournaments are a whole different beast because I always like to say this, tournaments are more like painting a beautiful picture, whereas cash games are more like a science. They're more of a math-based pursuit. You'd be like, okay, this is the stacks, and he's got 100K, but he's got 300K, and average stack is X, and there's Y amount up top, and this guy's doing this thing, and you have all this beautiful things that come together to paint this magical painting. And then when you're like, oh yeah, and I have 25% of that guy, or 20, or 15, or 10, or whatever it is, it's a lot harder in those instances to be really unbiased, I think. Another good example of this, by the way, there was a tournament where Kristen Bicknell and Alex Foxen ended up three-handed. They're dating at the time, I think. They ended up getting married. And they're three-handed versus another guy at the table. And, you know, they have a hand
aces,
where
jacks.
They get aces and jacks. And somehow it just really slows down and this thing ends up just, you know, getting played out. And you look at that hand and you think, okay, well, if they're not going to be getting in the aces and the jacks for 50 bigs or 40 bigs or whatever it was in this tournament, 60 bigs.
I think it was much more disgusting than that. It wasn't just that didn't get it in. I think it was like the jack managed to hit a jack and the aces, like, I think like Kristen had, I think she had the aces and she like folded. It was like not even the aces won. It was like the aces folded. Like that's how, like how crazy it was.
Yeah, I it's been too many years. I know I broke the hand down on YouTube. If you want to know what happened, you can go listen to me talk about it, I guess. It's been a couple of years now. But yeah, so spots like that are where it's really disgusting for the other guy because somebody should have busted there.
Yeah.
That's a spot where someone should go broke. And the fact that they don't, you're just doing it at the expense of the third guy. So I mean that's a good example. I think in tournaments it's more difficult. I don't see, so, you know, we say all these things, right? And it's a good conversation. It's a good thought experiment. But what kind of practical application can be done about this? And that's really where the rubber meets the road. It's one thing to talk about, we should have this, we should have that. And I'm not saying you can't have rules that are hard to enforce. Like, for example, murder is illegal. You need to have that even if there are cases occasionally it's hard to enforce. There are some rules you need to have regardless. But how can we actually practically implement procedures or standards in a way that prevent this from happening in poker?
I think first you have to have a standard. Like the insider info thing that I mentioned before, like crypto is not a security for the most part. Like it's not treated as securities. Like there is no government agency that's saying like you can't have insider info and like trade on it. It's sort of like a free-for-all right now. So you don't have that in stocks. Like in stocks, if somebody finds something out from the CEO, the CEO can go to jail. Like that person can go to jail. Like there's like this like really heavy like SEC enforcement because there is like some law to abide by. I'm not saying like they always catch people. I'm sure like a ton of like insider trading goes like undetected. But you know, the first step is to, like you say, like have something where you at least have a rule. Right now there's no rules. So if you say like, you know, no swapping is allowed here, people might still like do it like in, you know, behind closed doors, but you know, things can come out, like it creates like a little bit of like a risk to it. Or you say like, you know, you can swap until this point, this percent, whatever like the community wants. Like ultimately, like some of these high rollers are like way too big for people to be able to like withstand the, they want to play them because they want to be like part of that. They want to be like in the all-time money list. Like they want to play like these $1 million tournaments. If you want to like play $1 million tournament, you better be like bankrolled like well into the nine figures. And, you know, these guys just instead, they just like swap a bunch. Maybe you say that's allowed in this tournament and this tournament's not allowed. I don't know. At least have a rule and like we'll see if people follow it. But that's the first step.
I love that quote because it's been the elephant in the room for over a decade that I've never heard it put so bluntly. But ultimately, these high rollers are just way too big. And that is really the driving force, the problem in a lot of them, because the high rollers simply are way too big. You look at a 100K tournament. Yeah, there are guys that can play a 100K tournament. Most people cannot. When I won the one drop in 2017, I had, I think, 40% of myself or something, 42. I don't remember. I put it in a video somewhere because otherwise it's just way too big. I don't actually even think I had any swaps. I was too retired at that point. I mainly just have a hobby of making my friends money. But yeah, these high rollers are way too big for people. And when you have 100K and a guy's like, oh, I can play for 5K, but not 100K, and he sells 95% of his action, then obviously the situation becomes much different. And then if he has a swap, Lord forbid he has a swap, you have 5% of yourself and you have a 5% swap, you might have a situation where you have just as much equity yourself as you have another guy at the table. That can definitely happen.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Tough spots. I want to go back a little bit to the insider trading thing we talked a bit about earlier. And with cryptocurrency, purchasing some of these assets, something I've said a lot in this podcast is typically people should avoid trading. Because especially if you're going to be trading quite frequently, you're going to be trading against people that have an informational asymmetry to you. And this is a point that you made earlier. Basically, when people know things and they can trade off of that and you don't know them, they just have an advantage over you. And when you're taking positions in the market that are short term and going to change, well, the people that are on the opposite sides of those trades are oftentimes going to be professionals that are doing it as their source of income, and they have all this information and knowledge and strategies that you simply don't have. I'm not saying you can't make money trading. I know there are people that do, but the majority of people are far better off with just a long-term position hold because people can game daily stuff back and forth or weekly or monthly or whatever to their heart's content. But if you believe in the long-term thesis of Bitcoin as sound money, then in 3-5 years, or Ethereum, if you think Ethereum or whatever else you believe in, then you can't really day trade that into oblivion. As more people buy this and believe in the long-term value of the currency that you were talking about, you're going to simply make money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think like, you know, most people should not be trading. It doesn't even make sense, right? Like for most people, if they want to be part of the market, they can either follow somebody who knows what they're doing and just kind of like, you know, follow their advice and just like let them do all the research and know all the inside info. It just doesn't make sense to have like, you know, millions of individuals trying to figure out exactly like, you know, what's the latest info and what's the latest drop. Like most people should be like working on something that creates value. And yeah, like some people are really good at trading and they can do it. I think that's totally fine. I would push back a little bit on like the long-term thing. Like that's totally fine for Bitcoin or Ethereum. But like if you're like trying to speculate on like some other layer one or some app, like you're not going to just like buy it and leave it because like, you might have a thesis and it just completely changes if something else goes wrong. So if you have like one thing that you're just kind of following closely, like one community or like one project, I think it's totally fine to like try to trade the catalyst around it and just and see what's going on. But you definitely can't do it, like you said, like on a professional level. If there's like 50 coins you're trying to trade around, it's not going to work out. I definitely think like the informational advantage in crypto specifically is more than people like realize. And part of it's been math because everything's been going up for like the last 18 months. You know, when you're in a bull market, people can just like be long only. And even if they don't know what's going on, like they're just their coins just like randomly go up like 5x. They don't have to do anything. That's definitely going to change this year, like with like a kind of like a more of like a PvP environment. So you have to know a little bit more. Like obviously the time thing, that's like a good example where like if you just believed in like Danielle and that was kind of like your thesis, you know, like, I'm just going to have a long-term view. I'm just going to like leave my like money and time. You would really like have a you know, 95% whatever drop if you weren't trying to like trade a little bit around it and get out of some of these positions. I mean, when Zach dropped the bomb about, you know, who was behind time, things were already getting bad. There were already like, you know, quite a lot of liquidations there. But you know, like something like that, it just made it a lot worse, where if you're having a long-term view, you know, you're kind of screwed there.
For Ohm and for time. So at some point, if the token value drops enough, there is a number of tokens issued, and so there is a total market cap, and then there are actual reserves behind. So yeah. If there's a point where, let's just say, I'm going to just make up some numbers here. These are not in any way intended. Let's just say there's $100 million worth of Ohm out there. I don't know what the number is. And let's just say that there's $90 million in assets backing it. Well, it can really only drop so far, right? It can never drop below what is actually behind it in assets, right? Or is that not true?
It can drop below, and it has. And time was a perfect example. We just had it like way below backing. And eventually it kind of like came back because people were talking about like liquidating everything. So you're actually going to be potentially able to get like the book value of like your share, so to speak. But if there's no way to liquidate it and you don't trust the people who are actually like managing the money, that's sort of like the thing right now. Like, it's supposed to be a decentralized autonomous organization, but then like if the treasury is being managed centrally, you know, people have access to the money in their wallet. That's not really decentralized. And if you don't really trust them, then it can definitely like go below backing.
I didn't realize that it was controlled by a central wallet like that. I would have assumed that it was controlled through the DAO.
Yeah. I mean, there's been, you know, there's like a multi-sig, but like ultimately like some people have the ability to just move coins around and do whatever they want. There is a proposal now, finally, like someone is saying like, you know, this should be on chain and this should be like changed. And I think they'll have to do it. Otherwise, you know, it is a potential like liability legally if it's not decentralized, because then you kind of get into the security territory. But yeah, I mean, like Zach kind of exposing this Sifu situation where, you know, we had a convicted felon actually managing the treasury there is the type of thing that does kind of bring about changes and potentially like really good changes. That's why like, I think like ultimately having people point out like some of these like sketchy like things that are happening in the space can have like a really good positive impact. And yeah, we, you know, individuals get backlash. I got a lot of backlash. You got backlash. Like, I'm sure Zach, they were blaming Zach for like releasing this info. And they were like, what was the reason that the person who was like your source and told you about this like Sifu guy being behind like all this, they must have had some like ulterior motive to like release this. And it's like, okay, you're gonna shoot the messenger for like letting you know that there's like a known scammer behind like a huge treasury? Like, who cares what the reason was? Like, maybe like Sifu's girlfriend like realized he was cheating on her and like decided to like publicly like let everybody know. It doesn't matter. Like, just the pure like fact of it speaks for itself. Like, nobody cares what like the source's motivation is. It doesn't change anything.
That's a classic deflection tactic to make it about the person instead of the subject matter. That, I mean, that's just a really old textbook strategy to try and discredit and try and make it about something else and make it not about the thing that happened. One more crypto topic here, or I guess a couple different crypto topics here before we call it a day. I want changing gears a little bit. So do you have any thoughts on the current NFT space? Any projects you're excited about? How do you think the NFT space, I have another question I want to ask you. Let's start off with that one. What are your thoughts about the NFT space as it is today? What direction do you see it going, and what kind of projects do you like as it stands?
I mean, here's the thing I love about crypto. Like, you have like completely new things being created where like nobody knows how to value anything, what's going on. Like, NFTs was like one that just came out of nowhere, and like it's just, oh, there's like a picture of this and there's a picture of that, and like what's the rarity of the items on it, and what year was it created? So like, this is just a rock, but like this rock was created like in, you know, 2017, but like, you know, like we're just all trying to figure out like, how does everybody else value these things. It just becomes this like looking around and trying to figure out what society's value is going to be to these things. And it's just like very interesting. Like I love the fascination of it. I mean, ultimately what we realized is supply can like really flood the market. So if you don't have a very unique selling point to make you stand out, you will get drowned out. So like the value is actually attention. If you can get attention, there's a huge value to attention. And, you know, either you get it because you're like an OG and this is like a first project, or because you're like, you're doing something very cool. You know, after like the first couple that broke out, obviously, you know, Bored Apes, CryptoPunks, you know, at some point, like there was a little bit with like Penguins, like they had like their little moment in the sun that went away. And then like, you know, we just got flooded with stuff and it was a bunch of crap. And now we're starting to see like a bit of a resurgence.
I'm not going to sit by and let you talk about World of Women that way. That is a strong project, good fundamentals. I we need to at least have another tier here below the bunch of crap. Okay. This is the future of art, I think. By the way, I've got one 32 ETH. If you're in shit, I can no. I'm kidding.
I mean, now like you have the Azukis. Have you seen the Azukis? Like this is like the, you know, we finally have like a new blue chip.
How dare you insult my whammon with your Azukis? How do I spell that? Z-U?
A-Z-U-K-I-S. This is like the new like nerdy thing that like, you know, a lot of
14 ETH floor. Oh wow, this is popping.
It's getting up there. It's getting up there.
I like the way that you worded that though, that the value is the attention, because that's certainly true for NFTs. The more attention these things are able to garner, the more value that they're going to have. And absolutely, there are so many things popping off. Anyone can make 10,000 tokens of your own artwork. So there's just an endless supply of these NFTs. But there is also not just the attention. Projects that have sort of core fundamentals of people that believe in them or like what they represent, when the attention goes away, they can withstand it. And I think CryptoPunks, at least thus far, have been the best example of that. I know if you look at their USD adjusted price for the floor got above $500,000 and now it's down to 220 or whatever it is. It changes every day. Let's just call it $200,000. So of course they've had a big drop from the top, but in a market that has tons of other projects coming going all the time, they have actually managed to maintain a pretty good price stability. And then the other even better example would be Bored Apes, who have managed to consistently rise over time in their price value, despite the fact that they feel more stupid to me. I mean, that's obviously my personal opinion. I would say that I'm in more of the punk side of things for however much that's worth. But there are examples where even when the attention kind of gets taken away, they still manage to do well over time.
I think that, you know, the apes, like they did really well in like understanding the point about attention, because like they really invested a lot in getting celebrities who have like huge following and like just being able to get this like very public attention grab. And I think, you know, people underestimate, like, yeah, maybe like they just paid Justin Bieber to buy one and maybe they, you know, they gave it to Jimmy Fallon, whatever. But ultimately, like, you know, these people are like setting the trends in society and they're capturing a lot of, you know, tens of millions of people's attention. Meanwhile, CryptoPunks doesn't really have that. Like the team behind it is like much more conservative. They're not like really like pushing narratives that much. They're not even like letting you like own the IP. Like, I don't want to FUD CryptoPunks, but like they're not even like the Bitcoin of it, because it's not like they were the first. Like, they don't have the claim to be like the first collection. Like, there's these Curio cards, there's a bunch of other NFTs. So, you know, it's maybe the first one that like really got a lot of popularity and like kind of breached like a certain ceiling. But I don't know. I'm not sure like what the long-term play is. I'm a little bit more skeptical than a lot of the other people that I'm sure you talk to.
Yeah, you're gonna want to check your Telegram. I'm sure you have some nasty messages from Mike McDonald as we speak. I'll let you read those before we continue on with the podcast, because like, oof, those are gonna that's we haven't heard much punk FUD on the pod, but it's certainly oof. I was joking. Don't check Telegram. I was just joking. you're like, where's the messages? Okay, so interesting takes on NFTs. Overall, I agree with you. I like to see some new opinions, and I think that seeing some reasons why punks are maybe not so strong It's good to help shape someone's position. I will also say with punks, people aren't super thrilled about the team behind. The way that they did MeBits, the way they've done some of the other projects has felt a little bit off to some people. So that's kind of been a little bit part of the problem with their value over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah.
One of the cool things though about punks is that they created their own marketplace that doesn't have fees, which is huge. You could just use their marketplace. I think that was absolutely instrumental to the success of the project. So that's kind of a different aspect of it that I think might be underrated.
Yeah. The fees thing is huge. I mean, like the other thing I want to talk about a little bit is like Looks, because Looks Rare is a competitor to OpenSea, and OpenSea is kind of being this like fee sucker that, you know, because it's being the central platform, that's where the liquidity is. Like if you're a seller and you want to find a buyer, it has the most buyers because like there's all these retail people. And if you're like a buyer, most things are listed there. So it just kind of got into this like network effect where it just really managed to capture a lot of the market. And then just, you know, the fees that they've been collecting are huge, you know, like 2.5% or whatever it is, like on like huge volume. And ultimately, like, it's like a Web2 thing. Like all that money is just going to like traditional VCs. You know, the really big ones have been backing them, and they raised it $13 billion. And in a way, like Web3 is not supposed to be about like, you know, centralized platforms and VCs getting all the money. It's supposed to be, you know, Web3 is like this term that like can mean many things to different people, but ultimately like it means two things. It's like decentralization of platforms and community ownership. So having like a token, having some way of like owning it, and like, you know, OpenSea is very Web2. So, you know, one interesting project was Looks Rare, which is Web3 in the way that it's, you know, it's decentralized, you have anonymous devs behind it. So, you know, you can't really like attack it and shut it down. And at the same time, they're reducing fees a little bit. So it's like 2% instead of 2.5%. And the really interesting thing is that they have a token. You can own part of the platform. You can get some of the fees that people are paying. So there, I don't have any affiliation with this project. I've never talked to them. I never invested in this thing. But the reason, like, I think it's kind of like interesting is because they airdropped this token. So as long as you did any transaction in OpenSea last year above a certain threshold, you were just given this token for free. And here's why, like, you know, I love that is because I don't have to like go and buy this token. Like I was just given it. So there's no losers out of this situation. Like
what airdrop was this? I'm going to be honest.
Oh, did you miss this? Oh,
I'm,
no.
I'm
oh,
a complete, man. Complete noob with airdrops.
Oh, no.
I've never gotten one. I don't know where to get them. I always hear about them. I always check my wallet. I didn't. I always check a list. I didn't make it. And I just reached this point where I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm not someone that's ever going to get an airdrop.
Oh, Doug, I got bad news for you, man. Like they don't just drop it in your wallet. You have to go claim it. And usually like there's a certain amount of time you have. Like, so this
so
concept of
out.
Like,
am I not going to make it? Jordy, lay it on me straight. Am I not going to make it?
So there's been two airdrops to anybody who did things on OpenSea. One is SOS. That was the first one. That one is done. Like you're out of the window. The Looks Rare, I think you might want to check. You might have like a nice like 5-10K maybe like waiting for you, depending. I'm not sure if you know.
Hey, airdrops. airdrops are scams. Jordy, this is my take. Airdrops are scams because people can game it. They know who's getting it, not getting it. And then they can game it if you're in part of the team. And then it makes it so that only the knowledgeable insiders know where the money is or when they're getting it. And then they make some complicated hoops to make their own tokens worth more. Fuck airdrops. Fuck this process that rewards people for just checking all these lists. And you know what? Especially fuck all of those lists that I checked where like, maybe I got this airdrop. No, no, no. I got conditioned. Is it an airdrop? I didn't get it. I'm sick and tired of all this free money going to people that aren't me. And I've had enough.
It's really insane to think about like how valuable these airdrops have been. Like, you know, people still talk about
is
like,
it, Jordy?
Uniswap.
You're gonna rub salt in the wound.
I mean, this is like the world we live in where like, you know, you get an airdrop and it's like worth like a year's salary for some people, and all they had to
killing
do was
me.
Just I'm sorry. Okay, so just to get back to this, so they didn't airdrop to people who used OpenSea. So like, if you have used OpenSea in the last year and you like did over this amount of like transaction, you are our target customer. So we're going to give you for free a part of ownership of the site. And you can either sell it and just dump it on us right away, which like some people do, or you can stake it. So if you stake it, what's going to end up happening is you're going to start capturing like some percentage of the fees every day. So ultimately, like what they've done is like vampire attacked OpenSea, because OpenSea, all they have is that the network effect. The technology behind it is okay, but it's not that hard to replicate. The game of like having a token, I'm sure OpenSea people are very smart, and I'm sure they would love to have a token. But because it's like very like regulated, it's a very regulated company, it's like centralized, they can't actually have an airdrop. Sorry, if you'll just excuse me, I actually have to like charge my laptop. Get this plug 1 second.
All right, guys, we're going to wait while Jordy charges his laptop. It's okay. It's not an episode of the Doug Polk podcast without some technical difficulties. So I just want to say thank you, everyone, for tuning into the chat. I'm going to be taking questions from the audience live here on the podcast. Well, apparently Jordy opens a drawer. Maybe the cord's over there. Nope. Was it?
All good.
Okay, we're good. We're back. Sorry, chat. No questions. Actually, I'll answer one question here in the chat when someone levies a good one. Kim.net has a good comment here. OpenSea has no moat. And that's a good point, I think, from Kim.net, because for those of you who don't know what a moat is, it was a medieval castle term where if you didn't want the barbarians to be able to come over the walls and kill you and your family, you had a little canyon, little ditch with some water down there, maybe a few sharks if you could, lasers preferably, and then they couldn't get over the moat and into your castle. Well, OpenSea has had many, many, many other companies say they're going to try to do the exact same thing, but with all kinds of different strategies, lower fees, better user experience, whatever else, more users, Coinbase said they were doing their own NFT platform. There's been a plethora of places saying they're going to have NFT platforms. And so if OpenSea wants to kind of stay as the top dog in the NFT space, and I think there's a timer on that that's ticking very, very loudly for them, they're going to have to be willing to pivot and make some decisions that allow them to maintain this dominant position in the NFT space.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that they can't tap into this like Web3 power of, you know, having a token and being community owned, I think is ultimately like what's going to potentially like be a problem. Maybe it's not going to be LooksRare. Maybe they don't play the game right. There are a few problems with LooksRare. One is they haven't been like very careful in what they're trying to incentivize. So in order to get your airdrop, if you want to try to get it, Doug, you have to like list an NFT on their site and then you get it. So that's good. You know, they're forcing people to like learn the website. They're having to like, you know, become a user and like actually like put an NFT on the marketplace, which is great behavior because now like, you know, there's more NFTs for sale for people to come look at. So that's great. I think they have to keep like refining what they're doing because they're incentivizing people to just like trade and just trade like large amounts of money. So people just start wash trading with each other. Just like really, really large sums and, or like, you know, between their two wallets, whatever. And that's okay for a while because it just kind of gets like the attention. But ultimately, like you want to incentivize like specific things. Like for example, they could say, okay, like we will give you more airdrops. We'll give you more tokens if you list, a punk or an ape. Like we specifically want to target these two collections. And it has to be a real listing, which means like the price that you listed at has to be between like the floor and like 20% above the floor. So it has to be like a real listing. And then we will incentivize you for creating that liquidity. Like if they start doing things like that, then I think they can really take off. So we'll see like if they're smart enough to like get exactly like the execution right. It's very difficult. But, you know, incentivizing the right behavior is key.
Are you talking about when you say they, you mean OpenSea?
No, I'm talking about like LooksRare. So like LooksRare is like, imagine like, you know, OpenSea is 13 billion and then you have a new protocol that's like trying to compete and they have a token. And right now, like, you know, maybe like it's worth 5% of OpenSea, but that's still a lot of money and they can like decide where to sprinkle it and like what behavior they want to incentivize. So if they get it right, like nobody's losing because people are getting airdrops. No one's having to buy, like no one has to be like long this from scratch. And if they just give you like the incentives to start moving your behavior, the only loser is OpenSea.
And Doug, who missed his airdrop.
And Doug. Maybe you didn't miss it. Let's check. We'll check after. Okay, but good. Yeah, like one last thing on looks before we move on. I do want to comment. There's been a lot of kind of comments lately about the team cashing out a lot of money. They've cashed out, I think, like 10,000 ETH. I think is like the number that's being cashed out by the team who's been kind of working on this. And because they use Tornado Cash, it kind of looks sketchy because that's kind of like, that's even what like Sifu did. Even though, you know, I guess like they're saying that it's just because they want to protect their anonymity. I think it is a little bit of a problem. The problem is like people making too much money too fast and they just want to cash it out. It's generally like, you know, I'm a very active trader, and like the two things that I think about the most is like, one, is this project good? Like, is this coin like fundamentally sound? But then like, here's some alpha, like for the audience, the thing that like has made me like a bunch of money is I always think about who is like not like on a, you know, there's like log wealth and like linear wealth. Do you know this meme?
I don't know the meme. No.
Yeah. A bunch of like, you know, really rich people are basically like kind of saying like, you know, you should be like linear wealth, like a dollar is a dollar. And if you have like 10 million versus 20 million, like you should just kind of look at it linearly instead of like log wealth, which is more like utility based. So yeah, like the first 10 million changes your life and then the next 10 million doesn't. The reality is like, if people make too much return, they will cash out even if they're losing EV. Like you saw that with Solana. Like Solana just like made a lot of private investors so much money because like Multicoin, you know, the hedge fund got so many family offices and people into Solana, like, you know, a dollar. And when it went to $200, they just had so much profit to take out. So even if like the fundamental price of Solana should be like $500, when it's $200, if you imagine people have made like 200x on their investment, you know, they've made like, you know, 8-9 figures, they will just cash it out, like even if the fair price is higher and the EV is higher, because it's such like a, you know, it's like a very meaningful like utility for them.
Yeah, so this there's a poker analogy to this, which is you final table a huge tournament and some guy says, I'm not going to take less than X, and you look at and look what that leaves you with, and it's a hit for you, but there's $1 million base payout. So do you really gamble it up here when this money is $1 million to you, or do you just suck it up and pay that guy his money? And if you want to be that guy, you can head over to upswingpoker.com and learn. No, I'm just kidding. but that happens in poker as well.
Exactly. It happens everything in life. Like, you know, when the utility just becomes too great, like EV starts to like matter less. So, you know, I would say like with these like looks rare situation, it is a bit of a problem where they created so much wealth so fast, and like these people, they just want to take it off the table and like be able to like take care of their family, even if the project might be worth more than that. So, you know, you know, it's all a big experiment. Like all this crypto tokenomics is all a big experiment. I would say like going forward, it's something to like watch out for. Like if you don't want people to like sell out too fast, you can't make them too much money too fast. Just kind of like gradually let them realize their EV.
Interesting. Okay. Definitely interesting to think about. One last question here for you, Jordy, before we get into our new segment we're going to do after this. Earlier, you made some comments about sort of the macro perspective at the start of this podcast, where we're headed in the next year. And for many, many, many years in this bull run, let's call it an 11-year bull run, a 12-year bull run, 13, however many years you want to define this as, I heard people say the same, this kind of logic, a little bit different, but the bottom line being this: things have been too good for too long. Finally, things are going to change. This is the year. Watch out. I heard that in 2012. I heard that in 2013. I heard that in 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. And then the last couple of years, I think the Bears have just been beaten down with a stick so hard that they won't even pop their head out and say something because they're just getting whacked right back down in the hole. So when you say this about the markets and they've been in up-only mode for a super long time, you're kind of saying, to use the baseball analogy, that we're in the 9th-ish inning. Maybe it's the 8th inning, maybe something in that frame. Do you think it's kind of dangerous to predict that when people have been predicting that for many years now and they've been really wrong the whole time?
Yeah, like
Tough question, but I feel like it's a fair one.
I have personally never predicted it. And it's the first time that I've predicted it. So like I can't like look back and say like, well, I've been wrong before about this. I've been waiting for like a specific market combination that I've always had in my mind. Well, because I kind of, I've been following micro for many years, and I've always noticed that, you know, as soon as when equities like go down, people buy the dip. And the reason it works is because as soon as like they go down too much, the Fed starts like really kind of like easing conditions and like talking about like rate cuts. So like bonds go up, and that kind of like rebalances everything. And I've been waiting for the sign, like the kind of Batman sign, which is when both bonds and stocks are going down together. That's just a completely different game that we haven't had before. And it's only happened now, like, you know, since December. And I'm pretty sure, like, you know, this is the real deal. Like, if both bonds and stocks can go down, what it means is nobody's there to fix it. Like, if stocks go down, the Fed can't ease. They're like back against the wall. They've like gone to zero. They've done QE. They have nowhere to cut. You know, they just have to allow stocks to go down. Like, there's no Fed put right now.
I like your logic, and I'm inclined to agree. But I just will say that if it's another 2 years of just clear blue skies and nothing but, you know, the air beneath our feet as we watch the ground move off in the distance and we fly ever higher, I guess I wouldn't end up being that surprised. Okay, thank you for your takes and those. We're going to move into our new segment here. We're going to be closing out every podcast with, have I mentioned my personal life? And Jordy, I got a lot of my own stories here today. Of course, if anything fun has been going on with you, but I'm going to talk about some stuff. First off, big piece of news here. I took on a $200,000 body fat loss bet against Bill Perkins. I have 12 months. It started February 10th, 2000 of this year, obviously. And on February 10th of next year, I have to have lost half of my body fat. Now, a lot of opinions on Twitter about this. I tweeted, and unfortunately, I posted a shirtless picture of myself because Bill said I really should do it. So I sucked it up, and I took the heat.
But yeah, I saw that picture. Like, you didn't look that bad, actually. Like, I was kind of like, is that really 28%? Like, it's kind of okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously flexing and trying to not look super fat for it. So that's definitely helping me out a little bit. Also, most people just, they're way more fat than they realize.
That's true.
they you know, most people are like, oh shit, am I fat? Yes. Because if you don't really work on it, you're going to get fat pretty easily. Some people do a much better job than others, but most people dramatically underestimate how fat they are.
Yeah. I mean, it's so easy to like let go, like for a month, you know, you just like start eating pasta and pizza for a month. I mean, you're just going to get wrecked right away.
Absolutely wrecked. And then you're not doing cardio. You're not lifting weights. You're not doing it right. So my strategy month one, I'm at 27.7. I got to get down to 13.9. I've hired a bunch of people. I have a chef, I have a trainer and nutritionist. Oh. I have all this stuff, and they worry about all of that. And then they give me the outline of what I need to be doing. I follow it. I eat what they tell me to. And then every single month I'm getting a DEXA scan. If you guys want to follow along for super boring updates of what I'm eating and the days I'm doing cardio, head over to Instagram. I'm doing like an accountability log so you can see everything that I do and if I get there or not, and you can follow along. I'm already getting a lot of comments about my diet. I had this tortilla soup the other day. Okay. Or not okay. Tortilla, sorry. Tomato. It's tortilla. Maybe it's tortilla. Whatever was it was.
Was it like, tomato tortilla soup?
Probably. It had like grilled chicken and like a nice soup. And there was like, let's just say like 8 to 10 chips worth of like little tortilla strips broken down. They go on top. And we're like, bro, you can't get the tortilla strips in there. You're done. It's like, okay, guys, it's like day one here. Lunch one. I got 10 comments about the fact there was tortilla strips on top. So, guys.
I mean, the main thing you're going to have is like the discipline. It's about discipline and like, can you maintain? Because you know what you need to do. It's just like, can you do this every day in, day out? I don't know, maybe like your kind of poker training can help, because I'm sure like you need a lot of discipline to like, you know, reach like the really top levels of like heads up play. Like, do you think you're gonna have to like, tap into that?
Well, it's a little different with that, because with the heads up thing, I was so passionate about it. Like, I loved it. Every day I woke up and I was like, let's do this. I don't wake up and think, oh yeah, fucking treadmill today. Yeah, let's go. No, I don't do that. Like, I did an hour incline walk today. I was getting my heart pumping, doing some, like, I think it was mainly at like four and a half incline, and then 3.4 walk speed or whatever. It's like a quick walk. And I'm getting real sweaty and grinded out. I don't love that shit, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I'll do it. Yeah. I'll do what I have to do to win something, but it's just so boring.
What's your strategy? Like, are you just kind of hoping that, like, you know, you don't want to lose the money and that's going to drive you, or like, how are you going to do this?
I'm going to do my best to win. So I'm going to grind every day. I'm not going to eat outside of these meals. I think part of it is every meal I eat, I'm going to post on Instagram. So like, I'm never going to eat any crap because I don't want to have to be like, hey guys, here's what I'm eating for dinner during my weight loss body fat loss bet. I think that's going to be a huge, I already feel that pressure a little bit. Cause it's like, it's an accountability thing. If I know I have to take a picture of everything I eat, I'm just not going to eat dumb shit because I don't want to have to face the music of being like, hey, thousands of people, look at this dumb shit that I'm eating while I'm trying to lose body. So that's a big part of it for accountability.
Do you have like a kryptonite food though? Like, I feel like if I was ever going to do something like that, like ice cream would kind of, I would just be like so hard not to ever have ice cream for like a year. Like do you have anything like that?
I don't have a sweet tooth. My problem has always been drinking, and I've been on a pretty long sober streak here. So if I'm not drinking, I'm losing weight typically. And then if I'm drinking, I'm just getting hammered, to be totally honest with you. So that's a big part of it, sobriety. We'll play a key role here as well. There's a couple things I got coming up. I know I'll get a little bit wrecked on. I'm my bachelor party in a couple of months that, I'm sure that's going to be a little bit rough.
But said you have a whole year, right? So like, you know, you don't have to be like a Spartan, you know, for 365 days. I'm sure like you can kind of keep pace.
I mean, if you asked Instagram, I already ate 8 tortilla chips, so I guess I should probably just send Bill his money right now. I mean, the bet's in the can, that one. All right, my next story here. This is just kind of like a random story that happened to me a couple weeks ago. So, I go to a restaurant, it's like 2 weeks ago or something like that. And when I sit down to eat, I like to order sparkling water with lemon and lime. Makes it taste like something's going on, even though it's not. And so I order lemon and lime. The waitress says, she says, okay, she comes back, just lemons. And I say, oh, I ordered lime too. And she goes, oh, sorry about that. And she comes back. She says, we don't have any limes. And I'm like, okay, that's a little weird, but whatever. You know, no biggie. I'll just have lemon. Okay, my first dish comes out. On the dish, there's a lime, okay? Sitting on the dish. It's like part of a thing to sprinkle on the food. And she looks at me, and I look at her, and I just like point at the lime. And we just look at each other. We both look at the lime, and there's like a 5-second stare off here of like, what the hell? And then she's like, oh, well, we have limes, but it's not, you can't. And then I look at her and she looks at me and she's, I'll be right back. And she comes back with a little plate of limes, and I ended up getting some limes in my water. But what the hell was that? What went down there?
I think, you know, you gave her a bad vibe. She didn't want to like go above and beyond for the limes. Maybe she thought like you're being a bit too picky on that.
I guess, but we have no limes. When she was bringing that dish out, did she look down and think, I wonder if this is going to fly under the radar, the fact that there's a lime on this dish?
Okay, here's another theory. Like, you know, there's like a bar area where they prepare the drinks and it has like limes and like lemons over there. Maybe that area didn't have limes, but then the kitchen, maybe that had limes, and then she went above and beyond to go and get you from the kitchen, maybe.
That's probably right. That makes sense. It was one of those layouts, though, where the bar was basically part of the kitchen. It's kind of extended into it. So, you know, it probably wouldn't have been too hard to make the limes happen. But, yeah, maybe she did go above and beyond. Maybe I should be grateful that she ended up coming back with the limes. Because what I did was, after the 5-second stare off, I took the lime and I put it in my drink in front of her. And then I just had my lime in my drink. All right. I feel like that story needed to be shared. And then one last story, and then I want to talk about something else. I'm in an Airbnb battle with a landlord I had. I rented an Airbnb, so the Lodge Poker Room, I recently became a partner in it. It's pretty far from where I live. And so rather than driving 40 minutes back and forth every night, I said, you know what, I'll just get a place right by, and then it'll be a few minute drive, and I'll save 10 hours of driving because I'm there every day all week. My wife, Caitlin, checks in, and it's filthy, and then she opens the door into a room, and then a bunch of cockroaches scatter away, and one's dead in the ground, like in the middle of it. And she sends it to me. I said, okay, we're not staying there, obviously. I'm not going to stay in this cockroach den. So I responded back to the owner, we're not going to stay here. Send the pictures, one with the dead cockroach, dirty pictures. We're not going to stay here. And then there's some conversation back and forth or whatever. My assistant was mainly handling it. And then now I'm in this battle with the landlord to try and get my money back. And I'm trying to get Airbnb involved. And I spent zero nights there. We spent 1 hour at the residence. And I'm entrenched in warfare. And then this guy leaves me a review that's like, I guess Doug likes to stay at the Ritz-Carlton. Like, oh yeah, the Ritz, the high life, bougie Doug, wanting to live without cockroaches. Hell, man.
It is weird though, because like you can, what would happen if you got a refund? Would you still be able to leave a review? Like, is he buying your silence? That's my question. Like, is he saying like, okay, I'll refund, and that takes away your ability to like talk shit about us, and that's kind of like what I'm paying? Or are you able to like talk shit anyway?
Jordy, I have a standard going rate for silence. It's $1.2 million, and anything less than that is just simply not won't do. No, I'm on good terms with Negreanu now. But the point remains, he's not refunding shit. That guy is a dick. He is just not refunding shit. Airbnb is trying to give me a coupon now for the rest of my balance. Might end up taking it just because then I get my money back, but it really feels like it should be a refund. Shouldn't have to pay for cockroach dens, personal opinion. And then the last thing here, Jordy, how's the standing desk? I saw you have a standing desk today.
Yeah.
You have a standing desk. How's it treating you? You look like you're leaning pretty hard.
You know, we have these in the office. I don't normally like use them because of, yeah, I've seen like a bunch of your like fit poker guests use them. I thought I was going to do it, and it hasn't been too bad. I've made it through like the 2 hours. Yeah, maybe it'll be a habit. I'll start using it.
You know, Jordy, I actually have a standing desk myself. Did you know that?
Is it the one?
I'm sitting at it right now. Yeah, you see this?
What percentage of the time is it standing?
Okay. The standing desk was one of my most wasteful purchases of my entire life, and I bought golf clubs I used twice. I sit at this desk every day. It's annoying to move. My feet hurt almost immediately. I'm not built for standing. This was a complete waste of money. And the worst part was I sprung for all the extra options, and one of them was this support bar under the desk. I was like, oh, that sounds nice. I want some support. And if it's like this metal bar, and if I swing my leg for it, I smash my shin right into it. And I've just bruised my shins year after year. And finally, I just said, fuck it. And I'm selling this desk, and I'm having another normal desk, like a regular person that I can sit at. And yeah, Jack's bros can stand during interviews. I can't. My feet hurt, and I'm sitting back down.
I feel like there's another bet coming with Bill, maybe, around standing desks. Then, like, how long you can do a standing desk.
I think I would lose that one almost immediately. I have terrible feet. They're just designed badly. They're when I get my feet checked, like if I go to like an orthopedic, they're always like, oh wow, these arches are really high. I'm like, yeah, they are. Can't stand worth shit on those. All of my insoles and my shoes, they're like at this angle to try and make up for how bad my feet are.
Let's see, man. Maybe by the end of this bet, like you'll be jacked enough. You can join the club.
That'll help, actually.
What are the odds that you put on yourself? What's your like internal calculation on your EV on this? Is it 50-50? Is it 1-to-1, the bet?
It's 1-to-1.
Okay. So what do you think you're at?
It's difficult. It's so difficult to gauge because I'm, and this is sad, but I'm around the best shape of my life right now. Ooh, I'm in that ballpark. So yeah. I don't know what it's going to be like. I would imagine that I'm a pretty good sized favorite because 200K is a lot of money for me. And I mean, that's like 3 weeks of playing at the lodge. So it's a lot of money for me. So I'm definitely going to give it my best shot. And having the professional team of people working on it with me will help a lot too. So if month one, I've only lost like 1% body fat and I need to lose 14. Well, I know I'm way behind because it's easier at the start. So I can tailor my outline as I go along. So I would say I'm probably like 60, 70, 80% to make it. But I think there's a really good chance I don't make it. And there's a lot of people on Twitter, this is easy. I could do this in my sleep. Okay, well, first off, most of you are fat. And then some of you are not. Some of you are in very good shape. But for people that are in good shape, it's easy to say you could do this. Bodies are different. It's easier or harder for certain people. And then obviously, if you're in really good shape, you have a lot of self-control and discipline that, you know, clearly I haven't had in my life. So I'd say 2-1, 3-1, something like that to accomplish it.
Make it.
Yeah.
Okay. And like, how much are you spending on the team? Is it like 50K out of the 200, or like what's going to go? It's hard to tell.
I think it would be a lot of the 200, but the reality is this is about just, you know, look, I'm in my 30s. It's gonna be my last chance to kind of hit some good fitness. Obviously when you're in your 40s and 50s, you could be fit as well, but you know, kind of in my prime still. We're on the back half of the prime. I want to enjoy a little bit of peak prime, and this is gonna be my. What about you, Jordy? What's your health at today?
I had a baby a couple of years ago. She's 2.5 now, and you know, first thing goes out the window is sleep. Especially like this specific baby does not fall asleep for more than like a few hours in a row, so you have to kind of like wake up with her. Once like sleep goes out the window, those cookies start looking really good, man. And I do have a sweet tooth, so I'm not at the peak. I actually had a bet with a friend a couple years ago, like for Thanksgiving, like 2018, I think. Like we similarly put a big weight body fat percentage loss bet. He started at 17, and I started at 15, and it was like who's gonna get lower. And I got
even. So just straight up. So you just had a 2-point.
It was gonna be like which percentage like you reduced by. And I got to like 11.5.
Wow.
I'm probably like 25. I don't know. Like it just, you know, 2.5 years of a baby. I feel like I must have completely fallen apart. I haven't measured, and I don't want to.
Well, I'm considering having kids at some point the next year or two. So maybe this is something to look forward to. I don't know.
A lot of them sleep. I got one that likes to like have raves all night. She just like has too much fun.
Oh man, that's the tough part of parenting. One of the other guys at Upswing with me and the lodge, Matt Coletta, he's had a couple kids in the last few years, and we've definitely had some meetings where you can tell that it wasn't a good night at the Coletta household. One of the joys of parenthood.
Yeah, although you like adapt, like humans are gonna adapt to anything. So like at some point it just becomes normal life, and your body kind of like just says, okay, like here's what I have to work with. It's just that first year especially is like really is a bit tougher to adapt to. Yeah,
good to know that going into it. Hopefully I'll be ready when that day finally comes. Jordy, thank you for coming on the podcast. Anything that you want to promote here on what you're working on?
No, nothing specifically, but you know, if people like these flowers behind me, what's that? Got these really nice NFT flowers. It's a nice collection. I like the artist. I'm not trying to promote them, but I give them away for free sometimes because I think they make like a really good gift. So some of my followers have like proposed with them. It's the kind of thing that I like to kind of create some good vibes out there, just giving these away. So just watch out. It is Art Blocks. It is an Art Blocks collection called Flowers. So they are everywhere. They're not terribly expensive, and I think they kind of print out really nicely, and we have them around the office, and just a cool thing I thought I'd share.
Jordy, why didn't we do last week? Because Valentine's Day, yesterday? Or today? Yesterday. I'm romantic, you can tell. We could have had you on the pre-Valentine's Day. Now people are going to have to wait a whole year to be able to get those.
That's true. We'll have more opportunities.
Okay, sounds good. Jordy, thank you for coming onto the podcast. And thank you, viewer at home, for tuning in for today's episode. Make sure to hit that subscribe button, whatever platform you're on. We're all over the place, guys. Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, audio platforms. I was kind of surprised at some of the numbers we've had all over the place here. Podcast has been growing, and I'm excited for the future. We're going to be starting a new series with Mike Brady joining us for week one. Who is the greatest poker player of all time? We're going to have a definitive list ranked 1 to 20. We're going to kick it off with our opening episode next week. We're going to decide who should be in the top 20, and you are going to be the one voting. So make sure you tune in next week and join us on our journey. Thank you guys for tuning in for today's podcast. I'll see you next week.